Welcome to What Happened at ASH, the American Society of Hematology meetings in December 2025, immune thrombocytopenia. Are we entering a new age of treatment of this entity, specifically the use of BTK inhibitors and BAFF-R antagonists, B-cell activating factor receptor antagonists? This is a medical oncologist, Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Hani Alsamkari from the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston to discuss key papers presented at ASH, in particular, the VEHET-2 randomized trial presented as a late-breaking abstract looking at the combination of eltrombopag and ianalumab in the management of ITP. To begin, I asked Dr. Alsamkari to talk a little bit about the background of ianalumab. Let's talk a little bit about ianalumab, and I want to start out with, I guess, your vision for what the mechanism of action is, and also maybe you can comment again on how it got its name. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, so ianalumab, a B-cell activating factor receptor antagonist, or BAFF-R antagonist, is a monoclonal antibody directed against this receptor called BAFF, the BAFF receptor. This is very important in the differentiation, survival, maturation of B-cells, and also autoreactive B-cells that are problematic in ITP, and guiding those cells, right, to become the long-lived plasma cells that produce autoantibodies in ITP and cause all sorts of issues. And so it's called ianalumab because in addition to blocking the BAFF receptor and preventing the maturation of B cells, it also is a very potent B cell depleter. So it has a sort of two-headed mechanism of action. And it's named after the god Janus, or Janus, which is the same Janus as in Janus kinase. But in, I think it's Latin, it's pronounced Janus. And so it's ianalumab, and it's spelled with an I instead of a J. So that's where the name comes from. But it is a very, in addition to preventing the B cells from becoming, from maturing and surviving, it really very potently depletes B cells much better than an anti-CD20 antibody would, because it is glycoengineered to do so. And so very, very potent B cell depleter, get rid of all the B cells, prevent them from coming back in a way that could perpetuate or cause recurrence of the autoimmune process.
What do we know about adverse events? And also, can you talk about the method of administration? Do you see any infusion reactions?
Yeah, ianalumab in ITP is given as an intravenous infusion. In some of the autoimmune diseases outside of hematology that it's being evaluated in and has been shown to be efficacious in, like Sjogren's syndrome, like lupus, it's actually given as a subcutaneous injection. But in ITP, it's given as a once-monthly infusion. The infusion lasts about 2 hours. You do see infusion reactions, but they're usually mild to moderate, and the rate is pretty low. So about 10% of patients might have an infusion reaction. We pretreat patients with corticosteroids to try to minimize the chances of an infusion reaction. But it does happen. In the clinical trials, there were no, for example, VEHET-2 study, there were no severe infusion reactions. The rate of infusion reactions in the placebo arm was actually 8%, you know, in of itself, and that was the same as the low-dose ianalumab arm, and the high-dose ianalumab arm had a little bit higher, about 12-14% infusion reactions. But in any case, other side effects that we look for, right, about 10 to 15% of patients getting ianalumab in the VEHET-2 study had some transient neutropenia, right? So this is not the same as like rituximab-related kind of chronic neutropenia that we can see with patients that get a lot of doses of rituximab. This is like neutropenia for a few days, maybe a week, right? It's not something that we as the investigators thought was clinically significant. And very importantly, it didn't translate to any increase in the rate of infections or the severity of infections in the patients getting ianalumab compared with placebo.
Interesting, patients on placebo had infusion reactions. So I guess it makes it obvious that doing this kind of research is pretty useful to have a placebo control.
That's why we do placebo-controlled studies.
Yeah, I love those. One question that came up after you did your presentation at ASH, somebody asked you about impact on infections and also use of vaccines. What do we know about that? And also, I see it being studied in CLL.
Yes. So we don't know a lot yet about the impact of ianalumab on vaccination. If you give somebody ianalumab and then vaccinate them, right, that is possible, as with many other B-cell depleting drugs, that their response to the vaccination may not be optimal. However, we do know that the impact on IgG titers, which is obviously reflective of the current prior vaccinations that people have received, is very minimal. So IgG drops by about 10 to 15% after people receive a standard 4-infusion course of ianalumab, whether that's the high dose or the low dose. In the VEHA 2 study, that's what we saw, was a 10 to 15% drop. So not really believed to be clinically significant, but it is something that's being evaluated in terms of the vaccinations people get, like COVID and flu vaccines, after they get the ianalumab. Is it going to be like with rituximab, where you do see some failure of response? And you mentioned CLL, right? Right, with CLL, obviously we have this immune paresis problem as well, and immune dysregulation. With ITP, I would expect that to not be as significant in terms of, you know, I would expect more patients to respond to vaccination after receiving a B-cell depleting therapy, but we'll only know once we have the data.
So I don't know whether they looked at this or whether you've seen this in your own practice, but I wonder what would happen if you had a patient with ITP that you were giving ianalumab to who also had a history of allergies. Do you think it would improve the allergies?
It very well might. So, you know, I can speak from anecdotal experience, right? This is not this is the very low ends, right? But I have had patients have improvements in seasonal allergy symptoms after starting on either rilzabrutinib or receiving ianalumab, right? So that can be a two birds with one stone phenomenon in some cases, right? People that have problems with multiple autoimmune issues or have ATP, you might get some extra added benefit.
Let's talk about VEHIT-2, the big paper that you presented combining ianalumab with eltrombopag.
Yeah, so, you know, the treatment paradigm in ITP has been single-agent therapy, sequenced single-agent steroids up front, first line, patients relapse, then give a TPO-RA or other single-agent therapy. This study was really meant to kind of upset the apple cart a little bit, right? It was meant to look at things from a different way. Can we intervene early on in the course of people's ITP? The median time that people had ITP in VEHIT-2 was about 3 to 4 months, right? So they had just failed their first line of corticosteroids, and they were enrolled on the study and randomized 1:1:1 to get a high dose of ianalumab plus eltrombopag, a low dose of ianalumab plus eltrombopag, or placebo plus eltrombopag. So this wasn't just a placebo group like many ITP studies have. This is a active comparator group who had eltrombopag. Everybody got eltrombopag. And patients were treated for the 4 infusions of study drug and up to 6 months of eltrombopag. They were required to be tapered off at the 6-month point. And then we looked to see how people did. You know, what was their time to treatment failure? That was the primary endpoint. So we saw that patients who got ianalumab, whether it was a higher or lower dose of ianalumab, had significantly prolonged time to treatment failure compared with people getting placebo. And that was both statistically significant and clinically significant. And this was done with really very minimal impact in terms of toxicity, right? With no increase in infections or frequency of infections, no increase in severity of infections. Patients getting ianalumab had less bleeding than people that got only eltrombopag. Patients with ianalumab had better improvements in fatigue than people getting only eltrombopag. And one question that remains open: if we intervene early with a really potent drug like this, can we defang ITP? Can we reduce the severity of the disease? Can we prevent this? You know, 5 years down the line, is the patient going to be, maybe their platelet count 70, 80,000, they're not crashing, they're not in the hospital, who cares kind of ITP, instead of, you know, in the hospital once or twice a year with crashes and all of this. Can we reduce the severity of the disease by attacking it early? So that's a question that we will answer over the next few years as we continue to follow the patients.
What about the dose? It kind of, some of these variables, it does look like it's a little bit better with a higher dose. What I would assume this is going to get approved. I don't know. That's another question. Do you think it is going to get approved? But what dose do you think it's going to be?
Well, I think, I mean, given the data has been very, very positive so far, I'm obviously very hopeful it gets approved. In terms of the dose, that's one of the biggest outstanding questions. Thank you for asking that question, Neil. So, you know, you're absolutely right that people getting higher dose ianalumab had better overall platelet responses, the higher likelihood of having a complete response, kind of above 100,000, higher likelihood of achieving a platelet response with a platelet count above 50,000, right? The primary endpoint of the study was time to treatment failure, which really looked to make sure your platelet count didn't drop below 30,000 and you didn't bleed, right? So people did have more robust platelet counts with higher dose. On the flip side, there was also a little bit more neutropenia and a little bit more infusion reactions with the higher dose. So it remains an open question, but hopefully one that will be answered more definitively in VAHIT-1, which is the other big phase 3 pivotal trial of this drug in ITP that's looking at ianalumab plus corticosteroids in very first line of ITP. And we'll see, you know, the same dosing is being used in that one, the lower dose of 3 mg/kg, the higher dose of 9 mg/kg. And I would imagine that if the results, you know, don't point toward a really clear winner, then we'll probably err on the side of using the lower dose, would be my guess.
So let's talk about the other major development and what seems to be a new era in ITP management, the BTK inhibitor rilzabrutinib, and new data presented at the ASH meeting on the LUNA-3 study of this agent.
Rilzabrutinib is a later generation, some would say third generation BTK inhibitor. It is very targeted for the BTK with fewer off-target kinases impacted significantly than earlier agents like ibrutinib, rilzabrutinib, zanubrutinib. And the main purpose of rilzabrutinib development is actually in autoimmune disease. And so it was first developed in ITP. It's currently being evaluated in warm autoimmune hemolytic anemia. Why is it beneficial for it to be more targeted? Well, we recognize, right, with many of the earlier BTK inhibitors that they inhibit platelet function and they cause bleeding and they can cause, you know, really significant bleeding. And that would not be ideal to be giving to a patient with a platelet count of 10, right, who has ITP. So, you know, we recognize that with the additional selectivity that we're not causing any inhibition of platelet aggregation in patients with ITP receiving rilzabrutinib. And so it is a very potent inhibitor of B-cell maturation. It reduces the activity of macrophages and other phagocytes that would be destroying platelets. And it is something that we have very good data now in ITP and hopefully soon in warm autoimmune hemolysis that it can slow down the rate of destruction of platelets and improve platelet counts really substantially. One of the nice things about rilzabrutinib, people who respond to rilzabrutinib tend to have very stable platelet counts, almost between somewhat of a narrow band, like between 60 and 100,000, which is it's convenient and different than the thrombopoietin receptor agonist, right, which often cause a lot of up and down and up and down, sort of a roller coaster for many patients. Rilzabrutinib also, as an anti-inflammatory drug, has been demonstrated to have a significant improvement in fatigue in people with ITP. And it was actually really remarkable in the phase 3 study, LUNA-3, evaluating rilzabrutinib and ITP, the patients who were on the rilzabrutinib arm and had a platelet response did the best in terms of fatigue improvement. The patients who were on the placebo arm did the worst in terms of fatigue improvement. Their fatigue actually got worse. And the patients on the rilzabrutinib arm who didn't have a platelet response were intermediate between those two, right? So recognizing that even the impact on inflammation and therefore fatigue might be somewhat separate from the impact on improving platelet counts. In terms of toxicity, rilzabrutinib is reasonably well tolerated. It's got more side effects than a thrombopoietin receptor agonist typically would. TPO-RAs usually don't have side effects, or if they do, they're mild headaches and maybe 10% of patients. For rilzabrutinib, about a third of people do get some GI side effects. So this can be some heartburn, can be a little bit of diarrhea. It can be a feeling of dyspepsia. This does happen with. It's not that rare, about a third of people, but it's usually mild. I've never had to discontinue a patient because of this. It's things that can be managed with other medications, with taking the medication with food. And it often does get better over time. One downside of rilzabrutinib relative to the thrombopoietin receptor agonists is that rilzabrutinib it's administered twice daily. So as a BID drug, it's given 400 milligrams BID. As a BID drug, it is a little bit more, of an ask for patients than taking a once daily pill. But in general, this is also not a medicine that we expect to be unforgiving about missing a dose. Right? If somebody is well controlled and they miss a dose, it's probably not going to make a difference. That's at least one positive aspect, despite the fact that it's BID, to the dosing.
So just kind of curious, has it been looked at in CLL? And also, I guess the treatment's indefinite?
Yeah, the treatment is expected to be indefinite, although I will say, right, I've tapered patients off of rilzabrutinib, and they've maintained their responses, right? This is a very low N, so... with the mechanism, this could be disease-modifying in ITP, but it hasn't been evaluated in that regard, so we don't know really whether it is or not. But the expectation should be indefinite treatment. It's not being evaluated in CLL that I'm aware of. It is being evaluated in other autoimmune conditions. And as I mentioned, warm autoimmune hemolysis being one of them, but I believe it's also being looked at in some conditions outside of hematology, like in rheumatology. There's another third generation BTK inhibitor called remibrutinib that is already FDA approved to treat chronic spontaneous urticaria, as a dermatologic condition. And that's its only approval. So BTK inhibitors are really moving beyond use in just our field.
That's very interesting. One other thing that's interesting to note here is, that with the use of the BTK inhibitors we have in CLL, you have one of them, acalabrutinib, that for some weird reason you see headaches and you don't see it with the others. But I see here there's a little bit of headache signal here.
Yeah, it's definitely true. You can see in the rilzabrutinib group that the rate of headaches was higher and the rate of headaches believed to be related to the study drug was higher than the placebo arm. It's certainly an ongoing question. I would say, it would be good to have some additional longer-term real-world data to confirm that. I haven't had any patients have problems with headaches on rilzabrutinib, but it was seen in the study. So it is, another potential adverse event.
Yeah, there's sort of this myth out there that caffeine works on the acala headache, but it doesn't sound like it's a big enough problem that you'd even know about that.
I've not had an issue with headaches and rilza in my patients, but it's good to know if I do have a patient with a headache that's challenging, not responding to acetaminophen, I'll try caffeine.
So let's hear some more about rilzabrutinib and the data that was presented at ASH from the LUNA 3 trial.
LUNA 3 was the pivotal randomized placebo-controlled clinical trial of rilzabrutinib to treat immune thrombocytopenia. These patients had failed multiple prior lines of therapy and in general had failed many prior lines of therapy. So this is a overall heavily pretreated population who had disease for a very long period of time. Why is that relevant, right? Well, obviously, the more therapies that you've failed, the more overall refractory your disease is. The longer you've had ITP, the more time the autoimmune response in ITP has had to become more resistant to treatment. This is something that we recognize. We know that patients with ITP will develop oligoclonal T cell clones that become more varied in their distribution as people have the disease. And so this appears to drive refractoriness. So this is a very, you know, experienced population. Just important to note, right? It's not an easy group to get to respond. In LUNA 3, despite that rather substantially pretreated, difficult population, the study was statistically significant in terms of improvement in platelet response versus the placebo arm. The primary endpoint was a durable platelet response, and this is 8 out of 12 of the last platelet counts being above 50,000 threshold measured in the study, and 0% of patients in the placebo arm achieved it, and 23% of the patients in the rilzabrutinib arm achieved it. When you look at overall platelet response, any platelet response, that was 65% in the rilzabrutinib arm versus 33% in the placebo arm. The people's platelet counts, even if they didn't achieve the criteria, right, that patients receiving rilzabrutinib had better platelet counts, and we don't always need it to be above 50,000, right? Sometimes it's fine if it's above 20,000, above 30,000, the patient's not bleeding. Those are quote-unquote non-responders, but more likely to happen if you were getting rilzabrutinib versus a placebo. And so one of the secondary endpoints was fatigue. According to the ITP patient assessment questionnaire, or ITP-PAC, this is a disease-specific health-related quality of life tool used in clinical trials. And this showed significant improvements in fatigue that exceeded the minimal clinically important difference for the instrument in patients with ITP receiving rilzabrutinib compared with those receiving placebo, whose fatigue actually got worse. So, you know, and obviously this study showed that the drug was safe for patients with ITP, ultimately leading to its approval in ITP. And the most common side effects, again, are GI-related, typically in about a third of patients, usually mild to moderate.
How would you indirectly compare what was seen with rilzabrutinib compared to ianalumab in the YAHIT-3 study?
You know, the VAHIT-3 looked at a similar population as LUNA-3 did. It was a single-arm phase 2, so there was no placebo control, but very heavily pretreated patients. And in VAHIT-3, patients receiving ianalumab, 44% of them had a confirmed response that wasn't as rigorous as an endpoint, right? That was at least two platelet counts at least 1 week apart above 50,000 versus in the rilzabrutinib group, rilzabrutinib study, 8 out of the last 12 needed to be above 50,000. So that's a higher threshold. I would say that overall, you know, I would consider the drugs comparable in relapsed refractory type patients, with caveats that, you know, it's always difficult to compare two different studies. Patients receiving rilzabrutinib had side effects associated with rilzabrutinib, potentially, right, with GI stuff. The patients in VAHIT-3 getting ianalumab, the main things to worry about there are a little bit of transient neutropenia, some infusion-related reactions, typically very mild infusion-related reactions, and obviously the need to come in for infusions. But four monthly infusions versus, you know, a BID pill. So, you know, certain patients, right, would potentially prefer the shorter treatment interval and not have to take a pill chronically. At the same time, the improvement in fatigue on rilzabrutinib is very convincing for those patients that have a lot of fatigue with their disease.
Any information on one after the other, sequencing them? Would you see responses after the other?
As a general statement, no significant information on sequencing them, but that will certainly happen, right, in clinical practice, and that's something that is a topic of great interest. We want to know how, you know, if you give somebody ianalumab and they then relapse, what's their chances of responding to rilzabrutinib and vice versa?
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. El Samkari, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for What Happened at ASH 2025, ITP Edition.